This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Gore 2000, Mousavi 2009.
I call on all Americans to unite behind our next president. This is America. Just as we fight hard when the stakes are high, we close ranks and come together when the contest is done.
A resigned Al Gore, a defiant Mir Hussein Mousavi. Two disputed elections, two different outcomes. The world was watching both. One story, many headlines, not going gently into a political good night. Good morning. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, June 23rd. Listening to that Gore, boy, takes me back. I'm John Hockenberry. We're exploring how differently the world sees that disputed election in Iran and the whole idea of democracy in this dawn of the 21st century. Also, a divided Supreme Court gets narrow to dodge some big constitutional issues. And a look at the VA medical system. Is it a model for healthcare reform or more of a cautionary tale? All that and everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, investigators want to know how fast a D.C. area commuter train was going when it slammed into a stopped train, killing nine and injuring dozens more. They're searching the wreckage as we speak for data recorders. We're expecting an update from investigators shortly. We'll bring you the latest as we get it. Iran's top election authority will not allow a revote. The Guardian Council's new message today refuses to annul the controversial result. Today, Russia is backing that count, now saying the election results are, quote, internal matter. Iran will be a top topic when President Obama holds an early afternoon news conference today, and Wall Street hopes to recover from a rough day yesterday. The S&P and NASDAQ both lost more than 3%. The Dow fared a little bit better. The S&P starts trading today at 893, the Dow at 8339, the NASDAQ 1766. An array of voices on Iran this morning. One of them is Kouros Ismaili, an Iranian-American independent journalist and filmmaker who joins us in the studio now. Good morning, Kouros.
Good morning.
So what is the Muslim news audience in the Middle East hearing, you think, about Iran that is different from, say, CNN or The New York Times this morning?
Well, the audience in the Middle East, because of the cultural affinity with Iran and the familiarity of names, I think has a better understanding of internal Iranian politics.
So you get the procedure, you get the blow-by-blow more.
You get the fight amongst the top. You get this Ayatollah and that leader is lobbying with that group in order to sway them to the way they think, instead of, I think, the Western media, where it's mainly, you know, rioters versus government, where it's like people want freedom, the government's cracking down.
So more about Ahmadinejad and Khamenei in the Muslim and Middle Eastern media and less about Neda.
Exactly.
Stay with us, Kouros. More on all this coming up, and we have something for you to think about this morning and all day. A lot of citizen journalists out there, but we want you to be something of an editor. Come up with your headline for today's news. Is it, where are the nukes in Iran? Is it that you want another headline altogether?
This is Chrissy from Miami, Florida. Yes, Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan are important, but we're not concentrating on the problem here in the USA. I've been unemployed since October. We're not making it. The United States government is forgetting about the economic problem here.
Tell us your headline at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Voices of coverage in Iran from around the world. You can make your headline and send it to us. Iran in the news this morning on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin with the events unfolding in Iran. The latest this morning, Iran's top electoral body said today it found, quote, no major fraud and will not annul the results of the June 12th election, closing the door to a do-over sought by angry opposition supporters alleging systematic vote rigging. Since the vote, Iranian government officials have repeatedly suggested that a revote is extremely unlikely. However, Tuesday's announcement by Iran's top electoral body, the Guardian Council, was the clearest sign yet. in a ruling about a do-over. Meanwhile, the U.S. administration, those of you learning about this from our radio program or anywhere else, are having to cope with a frustrating lack of reliable information. Continuing now our discussion about the many voices and the many sort of slants and emphases in this story. Khoros Ismaili, Iranian-American independent journalist and filmmaker, has worked for Al Jazeera English for over four years. Good morning.
Good morning.
Once again. And we want to introduce Ramin Talai, a freelance photojournalist who works for The New York Times and Bloomberg, who's just arrived back in the U.S. from Tehran on Sunday from your direct coverage on the streets. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, I want to play two things for both of you, and let's get a sense of where the emphasis lies, depending on where you're listening to these stories coming out of Iran. If you were sitting in your living room, say, anywhere in the United States and turned on NBC last night, you would have heard Brian Williams say this.
On our broadcast tonight, show of force, security forces crush protesters in the streets of Tehran as a young woman's death now becomes a powerful symbol.
Of course, a reference there by Brian Williams, the nightly news anchor, to Nida, the footage of a woman who gravely injured in protests in Tehran. He describes her death or her injury as a powerful symbol. But this is what you would have heard at about the same time if you were listening to Al Jazeera English.
Hello, I'm Shihab Ratansi in Washington. Here are the main stories brought to you by Al Jazeera. Iran's Revolutionary Guard is threatening to crush any further protests that are deemed illegal in the country. Monday saw a resumption of large demonstrations in Tehran. Witnesses say they heard gunshots and that some were killed. Al Jazeera cannot verify any of those claims.
Okay, two very different beginnings of a broadcast. First of all, Khoros, what do you make of the difference there?
I think the American media has taken a huge step in the past week, actually. They started off reporting on Iran very much from a very confused standpoint of demonstrators fighting against the regime. And by now, I think from what I hear more and more, people are asking, well, actually, what are the demands? Let's get into understanding what the actual demands of the people are, rather than presuming that these are democratic fighting or, freedom fighting people who are violently fighting against an oppressive regime.
So less a search for powerful symbols, as Brian Williams says, and more. So what's the procedure here? What are the demands and how's the outcome going to be set? If I was listening outside of the United States, what kinds of reporting on the procedures in Iran would I be likely to hear?
Outside, you mean in the West?
I mean outside of the West.
Outside of the West?
Yeah.
The procedures, there is a little bit more of a Kremlinology happening in the Arab Muslim world about Iran than it is in the West, because people understand some of the power structures better over there. There's a lot of debate about which leader right now is fighting which leader, or what are the basic divisions amongst the various heads of various institutions in Iran. So you hear a lot more of that in the Muslim and Arab media than in the West.
So let's take it apart. Is Ayatollah Khamenei presiding over a divided clergy in Iran, and is the outcome of that likely to affect his future as supreme leader?
It is very likely that the power of the supreme leader is going to be changing in the next few years. We don't know. It could become more and more strong and more and more. The power could rise to the top a lot more, or it could actually, as a step towards reform, it could actually dissipate a lot more. This happened on Al Arabiya, which is a Saudi-owned news agency. They had a couple of pieces in which they basically suggested that the power structure on top of Iran is falling apart, that is becoming a Khamenei versus Rafsanjani fight, and they're both trying to undermine each other, and one is going to come out top and one is not. And that's a possibility, but that was a very big emphasis that Al Arabiya had, and it caused Al Arabiya offices, I think, to be closed in Tehran.
Interesting. And, of course, Rafsanjani, former president of Iran, and very much in the sort of fight here with the clergy in Iran. Ramin, from the streets, as a photographer, and, of course, reporting for Western media, are you seeing things that your editors back in the West have very little interest in, and how do you assess what Khoros is saying in terms of the people's perception of whether what Ayatollah is up and what Ayatollah is down and the disputes behind the scene, the criminology he talked about?
Right. It's kind of hard to assess all that. I mean, people on the streets don't really get to see it, NBC News, and when you're working there, you don't get to see, or hear what people are saying. You're seeing one side of the conflict or the issue. And it's hard to make all those political judgments about what's happening out there. But, I mean, and I think the main difference in terms of the reporting is East versus West. Al Jazeera is, you know, audience is mainly Muslim, you know, Eastern, and, you know, NBC, main U.S. Broadcaster. So, you know, I think that's one of the main issues.
Do you have a sense from the streets what the demands of the people are, or is it more a cat-and-mouse game between tear gas and security forces and crowds of young people?
It's hard, as an independent photographer and somebody who tries to, like, you know, be neutral at all times, it's my opinion is that they were just frustrated of the outcome. You know, it was, you know, a huge number of people participated, you know, what was it, 85%, and nobody expected that kind of numbers to come out the next day. Either way, you know, for pro-Mousavi or pro-Ahmadinejad. So the reaction was just sort of, nobody knew what's going to happen. I mean, every day was like, now what? And I think that was the thing. I mean, sort of evolved into, like, every day was like, so what are we going to do? What are we going to see today? And then next day was like the same thing and the same thing every day. And, you know, we are here today and it's like, again, what's going to happen?
What's going to happen today? Exactly. Right. Would you describe this as a deep grassroots uprising or more of a sense of, you know, very short-lived disgruntlement over, you know, some frustrations in the Iranian economy and maybe an inability to express oneself politically?
I think this is going to affect the Iranians and in all levels, you know, for a long time. I don't think this is short-term. And I don't think this is grassroots. I think this is, it's not organized, let's just put it that way. So grassroots maybe, but definitely not organized in a sense of, like, how the revolution came about. You know, I think the revolution was very organized by various groups, and I don't think these are the same kind of people out there. I think there is a sense of frustration, and that's what these people are trying to convey.
Well, we've been asking our listeners all morning, you know, the story of citizen journalists is all over the broadcast media with Twitter and all this amateur video that's everywhere and photographs that I presume compete with you, Ramin.
Right. Yeah.
So we're asking people to be citizen editors. What do they think the headline ought to be? Where do they think the emphasis should be placed on observing the story? What do you think the headline should be, Ramin? And then I'll ask you, Karas.
I don't know. I think the headline should be just it really, you know, what comes out of the, you know, the streets. I mean, you know, that's where things are happening. And
so the demonstrations are the headline in
your view. Yeah, and also, you know, how, you know, like we talked about, how is this going to affect Iran long term? I don't think this is a short-term issue.
Karas Ismaili, what do you think the headline should be for people who really want to know what's going on and feel free to, you know, express some criminology here? I was fascinated by that.
I think, what is happening in Iran today, from what I understand from last night to today, is that the demonstrations have been getting smaller. So the rallies are dying down. People are going back home more and more. And the establishment, the political establishment, is trying to figure out how to deal with this issue. By there have been some incredible interviews on Iranian television. So there's big steps in actually opening up the discussion about the elections
on Iranian television.
Oh, absolutely.
Will Ahmadinejad address the nation?
He has not yet, but the head of parliament gave a very important interview on the state television 2 days ago, in which he criticized the Guardian Council for taking sides in support of Ahmadinejad. He openly criticized Guardian Council.
What about Khamenei? You would think a supreme leader would have a few words to say to the people at a time like this.
Well, he said what he had to say on Friday. And what he said, which basically said, go home, the election stand, caused the huge riots and the deaths on Saturday.
So the next step is really important.
But he's been criticized, without being named, he's been criticized by many, many members of the Iranian elite.
Karas Ismaili, Iranian-American independent journalist and filmmaker, worked for Al Jazeera English for more than 4 years, will be attending a teach-in at New York University's Cantor Center tonight. The event begins at 6:30 p.m. and will be broadcast live on the web. You can see the photos of Iranian journalist Ramin Talai on thetakeaway.org. Thanks to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Just learning this morning that the longtime co-host of Johnny Carson, Ed McMahon, has died at the age of 86. Ed McMahon, coming over the wires and being reported on some of the networks. Ed McMahon, 86 years old, longtime co-host of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, dead at 86. So your headline for today's news, that's one of the things we're discussing as we look at the Iran coverage. Where are the nukes? Is it freedom for the Iranian people? What emphasis would you put on the Iranian coverage?
My name is Majid. What is going on in Iran is the money is shrinking for the regime's leaders, and they're fighting against each other and using innocent people on the street. And by the way, my understanding is it's very, very organized, and it's being organized by different parties in the regime.
You can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Another big story out of Washington, the Voting Rights Act. The government's top legislation against racial discrimination at the polls has survived a Supreme Court challenge. The court issued an 8-1 ruling yesterday in favor of a small Texas governing authority, a utility district, but it only narrowed the scope of the act, keeping intact its most fundamental components. Joining us now, Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, who's spoken with us about the Voting Rights Act before and this particular case. Professor Persily, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming back to the program. And it seems to me there are two issues here. One, the Voting Rights Act really essentially survives a deep challenge. Explain exactly what happened here.
Well, the Supreme Court blinked. Instead of deciding the sort of foundational question as to whether the Voting Rights Act is constitutional, they decided to cobble together an 8-person majority and basically decide a narrow statutory issue, which is whether this little utility district could escape from the act if it wanted to. A lot of us feared that what was likely to happen was that the Supreme Court was going to strike down the act as unconstitutional, as exceeding Congress's powers under the 14th Amendment.
And the 8-1 decision means, let's see, I'm not a court watcher like you. It seems to me that they couldn't get any sort of a consensus on the deep issue, so they're going to get an 8-1 decision on the fringe issue. Is this starting to develop into something of a legacy of the Roberts Court, in that they can't do serious issues without a divided vote, but something like this, they can get an 8-1?
It is possible that what this 8-1 ruling represents is a desire to water down the decision and to reach a broad consensus. I think there may be 5 votes to strike down the Voting Rights Act as unconstitutional. I was at the oral argument a few months ago, and even Justice Kennedy seemed very skeptical. But I think Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy may have decided, well, at least in this first case, we're going to send a warning to Congress that there are constitutional problems here, but we're not going to come out with our big hammer and strike down this act. We're going to just decide this narrow statutory issue and, you know, send a warning to Congress. There are several other cases, as you're suggesting, where Chief Justice Roberts has tried to expand the majority beyond 5 justices in controversial cases. That's true for some campaign finance cases. It's true for the Indiana voter ID case, where instead of just having a narrow 5-4 decision, and he tries to get 6 or 7 justices on his side.
You know, it seems to be one of the patterns of the Roberts Court is something that developed during the Bush administration, and that is when we were talking about military tribunals and the whole issue of Guantanamo, the pattern seemed to be the court would make a ruling, and the suggestion would be Congress needed to come up with some sort of legislation that would support what the administration was doing. And so the court would say, no, that's not quite right. Congress would come up with something. There'd be another challenge. Is that what's going on here, that the court would rather suggest that Congress modify the Voting Rights Act than actually focus on a real challenge up or down on the philosophy of the act itself?
I think they are giving Congress a second shot, but it's going to be difficult for Congress to satisfy the more conservative justices. It was quite clear that Chief Justice Roberts thinks there's something fundamentally unconstitutional about an act that singles out certain jurisdictions for coverage based on voting rights discrimination in the 1960s and 70s. So I think that Congress is going to have to come back and see whether they can loosen the strictures of the VRA, but what may happen is that they're just going to wait for the next case and sort of call the Supreme Court's bluff. If they're going to strike it down as unconstitutional, then they'll deal with that problem then.
All right, then quickly, Nate, if I'm in one of those districts that is being overseen under the Voting Rights Act, which has the historical tradition of suspicious sort of patterns at the polls, how do I feel this morning? And is there a challenge coming down the pipeline that actually might allow Justice Roberts to focus in on getting a majority to do something more radical to the act?
Well, yesterday's decision will have almost no practical impact. That's because most jurisdictions were eligible to bail out from the act already, and almost none of them took advantage of it. That has to do with whether maybe it's because they thought it was too burdensome to bail out. Maybe it's because no politician really wants to take as his cause celeb the idea of getting out from under a civil rights law. And some of these jurisdictions actually preferred to be covered because it gave a federal stamp of approval to their voting changes. Now, there's all types of jurisdictions that are covered under the act. Actually, parts of New York City, for example, are covered. And they find it more or less burdensome than some other areas like Georgia and Alabama, et cetera. There will be cases in the pipeline, I think, within a year. It's clear that the opponents of the VRA would like to have the court deal with the fundamental question as soon as possible, in particular before the 2011 redistricting cycle, which is when the VRA becomes most important.
So perhaps the takeaway is no changes to the law based on yesterday's decision, but a welcome to more challenges down the pipeline over the next couple of years. Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. Thanks, Nate. And we are asking for your headline regarding the situation in Iran. What do you think is most important? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. My headlines come from Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. An Iranian opposition candidate wants Iranians to hold ceremonies mourning those killed in election protests. Madiku Rubi is urging a day of mourning Thursday, and the call comes as the size and frequency of opposition demonstrations have declined. Meanwhile, Iran's Guardian Council announced today that it has found no evidence of a major fraud in the country's contested presidential election. Here's the council's spokesman.
Fortunately, we have witnessed no major irregularities during the country's recent presidential election, and therefore there is no reason to annul the election.
So this announcement comes just one day after it acknowledged that the number of votes exceeded the number of eligible voters by about 3 million.
I hate when that happens. It's
Okay, let's head home here for some sad news, actually. NBC News is reporting that Ed McMahon, the longtime co-host of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, has died. McMahon was recently hospitalized in Los Angeles for a bout of pneumonia. He was 86 years old. And finally, President Obama will hold a Rose Garden news conference today to discuss healthcare reform, energy legislation, and Iran's disputed elections. And later on, he will meet with the Chilean President, Michelle Bachelet. That is a look at some of the top stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Early this afternoon, the president will have a comment on the Iranian elections at a news conference that's scheduled for today. That will overtake the headlines. But we're getting some headlines in from you. Marty in Brentwood, New Jersey, emails us. Theological government attacks citizens, lies about vote count. That's the headline he would put on the Iranian coverage. The bigger issue for the U.S. response would be, he says, how could we negotiate about nuclear proliferation with a government that would lie about the vote count and violently abuse its own citizens? What's your headline? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The latest from Iran today, as we've been reporting all morning, Iran's top electoral body said it found no major fraud, will not annul the results of the June 12th election, and Ahmadinejad, the president, will apparently be sworn in soon. Today's announcement was the clearest sign that there will not be a re-vote. For more on what's happening in Iran, I spoke with Sadek Sabah, BBC Iranian Affairs analyst in London earlier this morning. In our interview, I asked Sadek to share his thoughts on the coverage of what's going on both in Iran and in the Middle East.
Obviously, we don't know exactly what is happening behind the scenes, but what we do know is a major figure in the ruling elite, Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was twice president and twice a speaker of Iranian parliament, was openly abused by Mr. Ahmadinejad during presidential debate and was accused of corruption. He is supporting Mr. Mousavi, the main challenger to Mr. Ahmadinejad. So Mr. Rafsanjani is one of the most senior figures in Iran. And constitutionally, he heads a body of clerics known as the Assembly of Experts, which can dismiss the supreme leader. I'm not saying that they are in a position to do it now, but I'm talking about the legal framework in Iran and the constitution. Whether he can get enough support from members of this body to dismiss the supreme leader, to me, it seems highly unlikely, because it appears to me that Ayatollah Khamenei is in total control of Iran's armed forces, the security forces, and the state broadcasting. But obviously, what we are seeing in Iran, on the one hand, we see demonstrations in the streets. On the other hand, a power struggle. And the combination of the two is making the foundations of the Islamic Republic, to some extent, trembling.
Now, are media reports inside Iran alluding to this process that you described, that at least in theory there can be a challenge to the supreme leader?
There are many rumors in Iran, yes. There are rumors that, for instance, Mr. Rafsanjani has gone to the holy city of Qom, where Iran's most conservative senior clerics live. Rumors say that he has met some of them to gain support, but these are rumors. And Mr. Rafsanjani's daughter, by the way, the other day was arrested in the streets for a couple of hours. So there is quite obvious that Mr. Rafsanjani is now on the other side of the leadership. I mean, he's supporting the opposition. He's not supporting openly, but it is quite clear to me that he's doing something behind the scenes. And also, we know that the former president, Mohammad Khatami, who is a reformist president, he is also supporting Mr. Mousavi, the main challenger, the opposition leader. And then there are also a division among the clerics themselves. An association of senior clerics also came to Mr. Mousavi's support yesterday. And they also asked for the annulment of the election. So now, you see divisions everywhere in Iran at the moment.
So let's just step back for a second. I mean, the American media and some in the West are fond of describing this as some sort of titanic battle between a younger generation, a younger educated Western familiar, if not pro-Western generation, versus a more conservative, perhaps working class generation that's allied with the conservative forces in Iran. Is that what's really going on here? I mean, are there any signs of an opposition demand for change within Iran that might have to do with the economy or with issues outside of which cleric is talking to whom?
Yes, indeed. I mean, there is, of course, this class divide is to some extent visible, yes. I mean, the more educated, urban, middle-class people are supporting the opposition. They want change. They want serious reforms in the government. They are challenging the supreme leader in Iran. And let's not forget, for the first time in the streets of Tehran, you are hearing death to Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader.
Wow.
And he has put his authority on the line by supporting one side in this dispute, i.e. Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Does this voice have any credibility? Here's Reza Pahlavi, former crown prince of Iran, son of the Shah, I believe, speaking in Washington. Listen to this and let's assess whether his voice has any resonance today in Iran.
The Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic decided to stand erect as a dam in front of this movement, sanctioning theft of the ballot box and flagrant fraud, all in the name of Islam. It was an ugly moment of disrespect for both God and man.
Sadiq Sabah, does the Pahlavi family, the royal family, the family of the Shah have any credibility in Iran today, even given the circumstances on the street?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. I think it is almost 30 years now that monarchy in Iran was overthrown, and the Shah was blamed for a lot of troubles in Iran at the time. And a lot of people, Iran has a young generation. I mean, there are two-thirds of Iranians are under the age of 30, and they don't remember anything of the monarchy.
No memory of the Shah whatsoever. And certainly we're seeing the limits of political discourse in Iran. The Shah, nope, no serious discussion of that. But the idea that people are chanting death to Khamenei in the streets is certainly an important takeaway this morning. Sadiq Sabah is the BBC's Iranian affairs analyst. Thanks so much. We talked to him earlier. He works alternately between the BBC World Service and the Persian radio and TV services at the BBC, which beam reports into Iran. And now, with more headlines, Femi Okay is here.
Thank you, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Russia is backing Iran's official count of the presidential election. It says that settling the election is strictly an internal matter. Here in the United States, the entertainer Ed McMahon has died. He was recently hospitalized in Los Angeles for pneumonia and also suffered from cancer. McMahon was famous for his role on The Tonight Show.
You know what he used to say on The Tonight Show?
Go ahead.
Hey-o!
You know, do it one more time.
No, I don't need to do it one more time. But, okay. Rest in peace, Ed McMahon. He was the host of Star Search, as you note here in the news.
Yeah.
What must he have thought of American Idol? I mean, Star Search, American Idol, the very same, right?
I think he would have loved to have been on that show.
He would have loved to. loved.
I'm looking through some clips so we can play them later on in the show.
Oh, I hope so.
And there's almost nothing he wouldn't do, actually. So
yeah,
he starred alongside Johnny Carson, of course, host of Star Search, and he died at age 86. He was in hospital in Los Angeles. In other news, we have a new batch of recordings and documents from the Nixon administration. They will be released today. They include 154 hours of tape and about 30,000 documents. The tapes are from the first 2 months of 1973, and that covers the time when the burglars who broke into the Watergate Hotel were convicted. And finally, Mexico has arrested 9 government officials on charges of negligent homicide in the daycare fire that killed 47 children earlier this
story.
Month.
Absolutely. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A tragedy in the nation's capital. Here's D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty.
They are literally moving pieces of train equipment, and then as we move a big piece of equipment, then searching to find any additional remains.
That's D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty in a news conference within the hour to describe some of the horrific details in a tragedy yesterday when 2 subway trains collided. It's been called the worst metro accident in Washington's history. At least 7 people died. The details we know now, it happened during rush hour above ground on one of the system's busiest lines. One train essentially rear-ended the other, and at the scene, one car was on top of the other. New York Times reporter Ian Urbina has been following this story. We learned some from the news conference, and the fact that this was above ground means it's visible for all to see. I mean, what a horrible tragedy. What do we know at this point?
In this morning's press conference, NTSB, so the federal safety officials, brought up some new concerns. Apparently in 2006, the federal safety officials warned the city transit system and made 2 key recommendations about an older series of trains, the 1000 series, that number one, those trains that the city still uses needed to be either retrofitted for safety precautions or phased out because they didn't seem crash ready. And secondly, that the entire transit system needed to be outfitted with the little black boxes, you know, the safety boxes that are so useful for investigations after crashes. And it, apparently the city did not heed those recommendations, and it turns out that the train that rammed into the sitting train was indeed one of these 1000 series.
One of the older trains.
Correct.
One of the, you know, I've ridden the metro system down in Washington for years and years. I used to live there back in the early 80s. It was always my impression that that system was not fully autonomous, that if two trains got too close to each other, the tracks actually, you know, powered down so that the trains couldn't hit each other.
That's
right. Obviously wrong.
Well, it's right in theory, but maybe wrong in practice. There is indeed a computer system that is meant to do just what you describe. It's meant to override an operator if two trains get too close to each other, or if they're accelerating too fast, or and that's one of the biggest mysteries. Why was this possible if that computer system was working?
Wow.
And also, the further safeguard is supposed to be the operator, the human themselves, and on such a clear day when visibility was clear, they weren't in a tunnel, why would the operator not have on her own, the one who was killed and who was driving the oncoming train, not have grabbed the brakes? Maybe there wasn't time, but there are questions about whether she was conscious, you know, perhaps there was a medical condition, or distracted, as was the case in the L.A. accident not that long ago.
Well, you're referring to Janice McMillan, who was one of the seven believed dead in the worst, what's being described as the worst metro accident in Washington, D.C.'s history. And there have been two major accidents in the history of that very modern system. Ian Urbina, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ian Urbina reporting the story of the tragedy in Washington for our partner, The New York Times.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Early this afternoon, the president is expected to talk about health care and Iran at a news conference. We'll have more on that, and we're talking about both of those today on The Takeaway, particularly what's your headline for today's Iran coverage. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now, Femi Okay has the headlines.
Thank you, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The White House now calls Iran's election protests, I'm going to quote here, the beginnings of change, end of quote. The White House press secretary says that demonstrators are succeeding in calling attention to what's happening in Iran. And this comes as Iran's top election authority says that it will not allow a re-vote. The Guardian Council's new message today refuses to annul the controversial result. Iran will be the hot topic when President Obama takes questions at a news conference this afternoon. Healthcare and energy legislation will also come up. TV legend Ed McMahon is dead at 86. He was best known as the longtime sidekick to Johnny Carson. I was digging around for some little bits of audio that might make you smile. Have a listen to this.
Shout out to my people. This is Ed McMahon, rolling slow through the suburbs in an unmarked van. I ran the strip in the 80s, brought big fat checks to the lady.
Could any other person do that rap? Very late in his career, when he was working to finance his various homes. Now, Ed McMahon died early this morning in Los Angeles. He will be dearly missed. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Once again, we turn to the discussion that's taking place all around the United States about health care reform as officials in Washington begin to deal with what the health care reform is that's likely to emerge from Congress, if any. Joining us now is Philip Longman, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Health Care is Better Than Yours. He joins us from Washington. Philip, good morning.
Good morning.
And Peter Ubel, a physician and behavioral scientist at the University of Michigan. He joins us from Ann Arbor. He's practiced medicine in the VA system for 15 years and is the author of Free Market Madness, Why Human Nature is at Odds with Economics and Why It Matters. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So why focus on the VA this morning? Well, since the 1970s, the Veterans Administration has digitized its medical system to coordinate medical care, and it serves now more than 5 million veterans. Is the Veterans Administration an example of electronic medical records, which the president talks about a lot in his health care reform strategy, and has that worked to reduce costs and make care better? Philip Longman, you first.
Okay, well, the VA has undergone a remarkable transformation in the 1990s and into today, and it has done so using information technology in ways that you can't find anywhere else in the American healthcare system. It has a completely integrated health IT system called VISTA that was developed by doctors for doctors starting in the 1970s, continually improved. It's a major source for reducing medical errors, but also it's come to the point now where it's changed the very practice of medicine at the VA because the digitalization of people's records allows researchers to go back after the fact and to see what works and what doesn't work. And that has brought the VA the ability to practice actual evidence-based medicine and to overcome the startling lack of data about outcomes, about what works and what doesn't in American healthcare.
So the principal advantage that you're describing there, aside from whatever efficiencies happen in the actual practice of care, it's having the data available to do research and to figure out ways of optimizing and even improving things more. Peter Ubel, do you think the VA model is translatable to the broader civilian healthcare system?
I think parts of it are, and other parts aren't. The VA not only has it's a tremendous place to practice medicine for me. I love it. And the electronic medical record definitely improves the way I practice medicine. But there's things that go along in the VA system you don't see in the rest of the system. We aren't incentivized in the VA to do procedures just to make more money. And we can spend more time with our patients and not worry that we're, you know, somehow losing out on the bottom line that you see a lot of people in private practice worried about. So I think the electronic medical record is just part of what makes the VA such a unique system.
Now, is the model that you're describing, though, Peter, a single-payer model that essentially if the VA was the model for the kinds of things you're talking about, spending more time with patients, not having incentives to add more tests, that sort of thing, is that simply an argument for getting rid of for-profit medicine?
It doesn't have to be done that way. I think it doesn't have to go to a single-payer system to change the incentives. We could still have a system with multiple payers, but try to have a more rational incentive system. For example, let me give just an example. We had a patient in the hospital last year who had been carrying a diagnosis of systemic lupus for 15 years or something like that. And it just didn't seem like the diagnosis made sense. And we dug through the electronic medical records and were able to figure out that this person had gotten misdiagnosed and that diagnosis was carried forward for many years. A little bit of laziness and bad habits. But the electronic medical record allowed us to find out the diagnosis was a mistake, and we were able to take this person off of medicines that were causing lots of complications.
Well, that's a great story. Philip Longman,
real quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
It took us an hour and a half to dig through all this and figure this out. That didn't pay, and another system that time would not have paid.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. Thanks for adding that detail, Peter Ubel. Philip Longman, we also have a story this week which broke on Sunday in both the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times that, in fact, prostate patients are having some serious difficulties in some sectors of the Veterans Administration. What do you make of that story in relationship with the kinds of successes you've described already?
Well, if you read the story carefully, quickly come to realize that this is an example of outsourcing. During the Bush years, there was tremendous pressure on the VA to outsource its procurement and health IT, and even in this case, prostate surgery. This was part of the philosophy of government that Bush had. VA took a licking in those years, but still kept ticking, so that today, even with those kind of problems, by all metrics of quality in healthcare, the VA comes out on top over and over again, which is quite impressive.
And we should remind people that the story in the New York Times, which is linked to our website, is all about people getting a particular treatment for prostate cancer, getting an excess dosage. Is that a fair characterization of the story?
Yeah, or dosage in the wrong place.
Dosage in the wrong place, exactly. So as the debate in Washington on health care reform gets started, Philip Longman, what is the chance that the VA is actually going to be a model and that it's going to be taken up by legislators and reformers?
Well, I think at the end of the day, when we're all done arguing about whether we're going to have a public program and how much it costs and how much we're going to expand coverage and such, people are going to realize that just expanding access to an already broken healthcare system is not really healthcare reform in itself. And they're going to look for places to improve quality and control costs. And really, the VA is the only example in American medicine of a place that has managed to literally reduce cost per patient at a time when medical inflation was running ahead in double digits and come out as the quality highlighter or quality bright star of the American healthcare system.
Philip,
what they do is something that we really should emulate. I think Peter's right that it's not just health IT. It has a lot to do with the kind of incentives that are on physicians. It has a lot to do with the fact that the VA as an institution has a lifelong relationship with its patients that begins after they leave the military and extends often to nursing home care.
Well, it's a great call for reform using a model that, as you say, has worked for the 5 million veterans who are served by the VA. Philip Longman, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare is Better Than Yours. And Peter Ubel, a physician and behavioral scientist at the University of Michigan. He has practiced medicine in the VA system for 15 years and is the author of Free Market Madness, Why Human Nature is at Odds with Economics and Why It Matters. Thanks to both of you. We're talking about Iran all day, but we want to hear what's striking you most about the coverage. Where should the emphasis be? Come up with your headline for today's news. Is it the nuke story? Where are the nukes in Iran? We haven't heard much about that. Is it freedom for the Iranian people? Is it the Obama administration's position on Iran? What headline would you put together? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. At our website, you can see photos of Iranian election journalist Ramin Talai. That's on thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can catch up on anything you missed by subscribing to our podcast. Subscribe now at iTunes or at thetakeaway.org. And here is your takeaway.
Let's not forget, for the first time in the streets of Tehran, you are hearing death to Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader.
That's Sadek Sabah, BBC Iranian affairs analyst. I'm John Hockenberry. All the coverage at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your headline and mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. I did say that, didn't I? This is the, what's the name of the show? It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
History and its lessons.
In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well known.
The United States and Iran have been stepping through history together for more than 60 years. The entwined fates of two nations clear the global dance floor, and the whole world watches.
When we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
Cheeky? Oh, that's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, June 23rd, and we are exploring the fact that the historical relationship between Iran and the U.S. is actually a pretty close one, whether in conflict or as allies. Iranians in America's neighborhood on the show this morning. Also, lessons from the Chris Brown Rihanna story, and where do computers go when they die? Well, if you think they're recycled, think again. Those stories and everything you need to know today. In the headlines, the top federal transport regulator says the D.C. commuter train that slammed into another yesterday was marked for phasing out 3 years ago. At least seven died in the wreck and many more were injured. The National Transportation Safety Board and others will look into why that car wasn't retired or retrofitted as investigators study the crash. The White House now calls Iran's election protests, quote, the beginnings of change. Iran's top election authority will not allow a revote. The Guardian Council's new message today refuses to annul the controversial result. TV legend Ed McMahon is dead at 86, best known as the longtime sidekick to Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Wall Street hopes to recover from a rough day yesterday. The S&P and NASDAQ both lost more than 3%. The Dow fared only a little better. The S&P starts trading at 893, the Dow at 8339, the NASDAQ at 1766, and futures trading suggests a bump up from the bottom in the early going. You'll be hearing from a variety of voices on Iran this morning, Iranian Americans or Iranians in the United States, among them Kelly Nicknajad, editor of TehranBureau.com. Kelly, thanks for joining us. And what's a truth and a myth that you've heard in all of the coverage so far since June 12th?
A myth would be that Iran right now is divided, is two different countries. You know, one strongly in support of Mr. Ahmadinejad and another one, some elite kids in North Tehran who want more freedom. That's a myth. The truth is that it's a historical moment and it's very significant, and it's going to be very difficult to put the genie back into the bottle.
And is that what they're attempting to do in Iran right now?
To put the genie back in the bottle,
right?
Of course, I think, I would imagine.
Kelly will stay with us. More voices this hour as part of our continuing coverage of Iran. And we also have something for you to think about all morning and all day. We're talking about Iran, but we want to hear what's striking you most about the coverage. Come up with a headline for today's news out of Iran. Is it where the nukes are in Iran? Is it nuclear proliferation? Is it freedom for the Iranian people? Is it that Obama isn't doing enough to stand either with the hardliners or to stay away from this altogether? Or another headline altogether. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Iranian American voices coming up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. We've been focusing all week on the situation in Iran. It's a story about a country far away from the United States, but it's also a story about our neighbors. Many of the people on your own street, in your own neighborhood, are having their own very personal relationship with what's going on in Iran. We're going to hear some of those voices today. The latest from Iran today, Iran's top electoral body said it found no major fraud and will not annul the results of the June 12th election. That closes the door to a so-called do-over sought by angry opposition supporters alleging systematic vote rigging. It was the clearest yet ruling on a do-over and the fact that the election result will apparently stand. But it's a domestic story. As unrest in Iran continues, the question of which sources to use and which to dismiss in covering the unrest in Tehran is becoming more of an issue for anyone reading the news. But there are different priorities for Iranian Americans, journalists, and even the Obama administration. Everyone following the news has to form their own opinions from a mix of news reports, Twitter feeds, third-hand accounts. Joining us are three people who represent different points of media consumption on Iran like right now, but the story is very, very close to the heart of all of them. Kelly Nicknajad, we were just speaking with, is founder and editor of TehranBureau.com, an Iranian news site and aggregator of all kinds of news. Kelly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us again is Amir Farouki, an Iranian-American attorney in Atlanta, where The Takeaway is on the air. And we also have an artist who moved from Iran to America just 1 year ago. She's in the studio with me. We're going to call her Nazee for the purposes of this interview. Her real name she doesn't want us to use for reasons that we will actually discuss. First of all, Amir, thanks for joining us again.
It's my pleasure.
And Nazee, let me begin with you. You've been watching the coverage, and as someone who's returning to Iran in the next couple of weeks, correct?
Yes.
I mean, how do you make sense of what's going on, and what do you expect to find when you return home?
Yeah, actually, it's very shocking. I can't believe that, you know, these things are happening. But fortunately, I'm in contact with Iran every day, at least twice a day, so I have the sense, you know, from there, so I'm sure when I go there, I know exactly what's going on because I talk with people every day, twice, three times a day. And
family safe?
Yeah, family, I mean, depends how you, you know, define safe.
Right, right. No brothers and sisters out in the streets at this point, or do you have
Yes, I have my very close family members out in the streets, and it's very interesting that I see different type of, you know, persons now in my family and among my colleagues and my friends, which are more artists and lecturers, are in the streets. And it's amazing how they feel right now.
Amir Farouki, how have your neighbors changed their view of you in the midst of all of this? I mean, I suspect everyone knew you were Iranian-American, but all of a sudden your identity is at the center of a global news story.
Right. Well, yeah, I kind of straddled the line. My mother is American. My father is from Iran. But what I think we're seeing is this widespread support within the Iranian-American community, but also outside, of this brave reawakening of an Iran that many people had forgotten existed to begin with, you know, this progressive, opinionated, more moderate Iran. And I also think we're seeing an embrace of kind of a manifestation of a backlash against Ahmadinejad's sometimes demonization of the Iranian people by way of his rhetoric.
You're running for city council there in Atlanta, right?
That's correct.
I mean, does this raise your profile? I mean, any sort of bumper stickers, a vote for Amir Farouki is a vote for Mousavi?
I don't think so. I think my race is about the efficiency and effectiveness of city government. It's not about my identity. And I don't message myself in that way at all. I'm born and raised in the United States, born and raised in Atlanta, for that matter. And I jumped into the city council race, and I'm campaigning on city issues, which is...
Well, no, of course, and I don't mean any disrespect, but it is interesting that an identity that has remained, in some sense, in the background, is suddenly transforming Iranian-Americans here in the United States, and there are 500,000 in Southern California and many, many more all around the United States. Kelly Nicknajad, editor and founder of Tehran Bureau, what do you think the influence of expatriate Iranians is in what's going on in Tehran right now?
It could be very dangerous. What I've noticed is that certain French diaspora groups are trying to hijack this movement for their own failed purposes over the past 30 years. And it's very important to show solidarity with what's going on, but it's also a different thing to try to use this to air their grievances and make it be about them. So that's been unfortunate, and that's something that is not doing anyone any help by associating, you know, groups that have nothing to do with what's going on because you know, it can be used against them. Things that don't exist will be used against them, let alone when there's there's evidence to suggest you can use something against them. So it's very dangerous, you know, but
Well, certainly the narrative of foreign stooges bringing down a revolution inside a country, especially if it's directed from the United States, is a familiar one in Iran. And Barack Obama, we ran a clip from his Cairo speech where he talked specifically about the U.S. role in bringing down the Mossadegh government in 1953. As you hear, Kelly, the calls by certain Republican lawmakers that Barack Obama needs to stand up and take more of a stand for the opposition, do you think that is appropriate here? And what do Iranian Americans think about this approach of the Obama administration?
You know, it's very tricky. It's a very difficult one. I don't think it's a black and white issue. I think what's important is that we don't do anything to crush a democratic movement that has been taking form over the past 30 years at least, and it's manifested in this way. So, you know, like Mr. Obama said, you know, 1953, we orchestrated a coup against, Mossadegh and crushed that democratic movement, or at least nipped it in the bud. So anything we do wrong now to turn the Iranian people against the West would be to crush it. So if we do, earlier when the election was taking, soon after the election, President Obama said that he will continue to reach out to whoever is declared president of Iran. That's not neutrality, and that's not winning any fans. So what I've heard, again, it's not my opinion, but things that I've heard from Iran, from various people in different places, in different situations, was that, you know, the United States has a moral obligation. The world, I mean, it wasn't pinpointed at the United States, but the West, Europe, has a moral obligation to stand up for human rights. And, of course,
and stand with the opposition by implication. Nazee, do you agree with that? Is that what you're hearing from inside Iran? And what do you think personally about that?
Yeah, actually, I think it's true. And it's, in my opinion, it's very important. You know, I just got an email this morning from a friend in Tehran that he insisted that the Western prescription is not for us, and just demand the help of Iranian people outside Iran, the lecturers, the intellectuals, the professors, the political analysts, that they help us to, you know, reach our achievement and be united. And I think the help of Obama or American government directly is very, very dangerous right now.
Amir Farouki, is there unanimity among Iranian Americans about what to do from the Washington perspective?
I don't think so. I think we're seeing a bit of a generational gap in response to what's going on in Iran. You have, as Kelly mentioned, there's an element of the Iranian American community, this kind of pro-monarchy group that has been trying for 30-plus years to return to Iran, and they've kind of muddied the waters a bit. But I think generally those under the age of 40 who are there in spirit and see themselves as brothers and sisters of those who are on the streets have viewed the American response as dead-on. And I think Obama has towed a dead-on but delicate stance of standing up for free speech and freedom of assembly, but not injecting the United States into domestic politics in Iran. Because, as Kelly and Nazee mentioned, when we do that, we tend to give the hardliners ground to push back and to demonize the reformers.
Right, and Obama is likely to say more about this at a news conference later today. We've been asking everybody, what's the headline? What would the headline be for you where the emphasis should be on this story? Very quickly, Amir Farouki, what do you think?
The reawakening of Iran.
Nazee, what do you think the headline should be on what's going on in Iran? Story of freedom, moment of history, or wait and see? Nazee?
I think put aside all different agendas and just be united.
Kelly, you want to give us a last word?
The awakening is good.
The awakening is good. Kelly Niknejad, editor and founder of Tehran Bureau, a site that aggregates news on Iran. Nazee, an Iranian artist working in New York on her way back to her home country in the next couple of weeks. And Amir Farouki, attorney in Atlanta, member of the Iranian American community there, also running for city council. Amir, thanks.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Well, my 10-year-old daughters are not talking about Iran around the breakfast table this morning. They're talking about what's going on between Chris Brown and Rihanna. We're going to have a discussion of that, not with my 10-year-olds, coming right up. But first, what's your headline for today's news? We're talking about Iran all day, but we want to hear what you're taking away from all of the coverage around the world. Is it freedom for the Iranian people? Is it the Obama administration's policies? Or do you want another headline altogether?
I'm Ellie. I am puzzled and dubious about the coverage of events in Iran. China, a nation we are intimately linked with and whom we largely refrain from criticizing, does not permit anything like such open expression of dissidence as we are seeing in Iran. In this context, the shock and dismay in the U.S. at events in Iran seems disingenuous to me and makes Iran look like a beacon of openness.
More of a column than a headline, but that's okay. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Singer Chris Brown pled guilty yesterday to felony assault charges. Brown was arrested in February, you may remember, for beating his then-girlfriend, 20-year-old pop star Rihanna Fenty. A judge put Brown on probation for 5 years, ordered him to complete 180 hours of community service. What happens to his career is up to his fans. Brown's plea means Rihanna does not have to take the stand, so the details of what happened on the night of the assault will remain secret. The story of Chris Brown and Rihanna sparked conversations about gender abuse, race, celebrity, and youth throughout the media and really among the people all over America. In studio with us to continue that discussion is journalist Elizabeth Mendez-Barry. She drew attention to partner abuse in the hip-hop world with a 2005 article on hip-hop artist Big Pun. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
And also joining us is LaToya Peterson. She's with us from Washington, D.C. She's editor of the blog Racialicious. Good morning to you, LaToya.
Good morning.
What do we learn from these people, and what do we fail to learn now that the details are going to be secret and the guilty plea means that the court drama is over? LaToya?
Well, I think one of the things that we learn is that domestic violence really does strike and impact every community. And it was interesting to watch how the language that we use to describe and discuss domestic violence really hasn't changed. The fact that these two kids were celebrities and were so famous drew additional scrutiny on this case, but it seems that we have so much farther to go when it comes to having a productive conversation about what domestic violence looks like and how to prevent it.
Elizabeth, has this been a moment where people can be educated on teen violence, or do teens get more of an idea of, all right, if something like that happened to me, here's how I would save my career, and they're looking at that more than the issue of violence itself?
I think it's been a combination. I think that there have been some really, really productive conversations that have happened, but I think there's also been a lot of polarized sort of side-taking, Team Rihanna, Team Breezy, as if, you know, someone wins at the end. I don't really know how constructive that has been.
What do you make of the narrative that happened really shortly after the attack, Elizabeth? And I want to comment from you, LaToya, that Rihanna appeared to reject her, I guess at that point, former boyfriend, and then appeared to at least allow for the possibility that they might get back together again. And this was, of course, taken up by the media as an example of exactly what you should not do if you're a victim of violence at any age. Elizabeth?
Well, I mean, I think most women who are victims of domestic abuse wind up going up to their partners at least a few times before they make a definitive cut. And I think one of the things that people fail to understand is that when it gets to the point that he's choking her, which is what we learned from the affidavit that leaked by the LAPD, there's scaffolding, there's emotional abuse that has facilitated that. And that's something we don't talk about as much, but that's why I think she was willing to go back. And that's where we really need to have a conversation. It's not as easy and it's not as obvious, but it needs to happen.
LaToya, do you think the punishment, and comment on anything Elizabeth has said, but do you think the punishment fits the crime here for Chris Brown?
Well, first I want to go back to something that Elizabeth said
sure.
in her quick segment here, and I completely agree that one of the things that people seem to underestimate in this case is, one, their ages, that they're both just out of adolescence and that they're both really struggling with their image and who they are. And so when you combine that with a relationship that's in any form abusive, emotional or physical, that it's going to be a lot more difficult for a person at that age to want to, or at any age rather, to want to try to pull themselves out of that situation and make it more difficult. In terms of does the punishment fit the crime, I can understand why each one of them would benefit from not having any more details leak. It seems like they've both been trying to distance themselves as much as possible from this incident, and it feels like there's definitely a narrative emerging that Rihanna needs to be an advocate for women's rights, but she may or may not be ready for that. I mean, Elizabeth, what do you think?
I agree. I think one of the crazy things about the situation is that Rihanna actually hasn't done anything in this whole process. She did not call 911. She did not release her name. It was the LA Times that did that. And the devastating photograph of her was released by the LAPD. It was leaked. And at this point, she was subpoenaed to appear yesterday. So it wasn't a situation where she was coming forward and saying, I want to be advocate for victims everywhere. I mean, she's very young. She's just sort of coming out of this, it seems like. And you know, part of me wants her to be a heroine, but part of me just wants her to be a regular human being and heal.
Have they lost the ability to be regular human beings, these two? They're such celebrities. They have these images that there's actual serious dollar amounts they have to. I mean, Chris Brown had a squeaky clean image before this. That's probably gone forever. But nevertheless, there is an incentive always to cover this sort of thing up. Elizabeth, LaToya?
Well, yeah, I agree with that. There is the issue that comes with fame is that you can't make the same kind of mistakes that you would make and allow that to work out. So had this been, I would say, a normal teenage relationship, unfortunately, the probability is that she probably would have stayed with him a few more times. They would have broken up and got back together. That's part of the process of separating the self from your abuser.
On the other hand, he might have killed her, right? Because
he might have killed
her. What we saw in the affidavit is that it was an incredibly devastating attack that involved choking and threats. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, but that's a very good point, Elizabeth, that a lot of these relationships do end in death, unfortunately. But because of the scrutiny involved with the fact that this was, you know, this went all over the blogosphere, this sparked all kinds of tensions, and with the fact of the amounts of money, exactly as you brought up, with the amounts of money in play, there's a lot of pressure on them to either reconcile so that everything will be okay, so that they both can salvage their careers, but there was suddenly an impasse.
Well, you know, it's the question really there is, what message does that implicitly deliver when you're preserving your career, you're also preserving your life? So LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious.com, is in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Mendez-Berry, freelance journalist, author of Love Hurts, a 2005 article for Vibe magazine exploring partner abuse in hip-hop. We're talking about the fact that Chris Brown pled guilty yesterday and was given a sentence in the case where he assaulted his then-girlfriend Rihanna. What implication, what sort of teachable moments come from this event? We're continuing that discussion. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, an update on Rihanna, Chris Brown, their future, and teen violence, right after headlines from Femi OK.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes to the top of the hour. pause there for dramatic
kind
effect.
Kind of casual there, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Just sitting back, or feet are on the desk here.
I don't think we pay enough attention to silence, personally. So, just getting news in from the... Do you think I cover that really well?
Paging dead air. Oh. Dead air.
Okay.
Please pick up the white courtesy phone.
Are you done mocking
more
me?
More dead air. Thank you, Femi.
Just getting news in from the Associated Press that airplane manufacturer Boeing is delaying the first test flight of its long-awaited 787 airplane. Federal investigators are looking for recorders or other devices that could tell them how fast a Washington subway train was going when it plowed into another train yesterday. And also, it killed at least seven people, injured many others. I was listening to a press conference this morning from the mayor of D.C., Adrian Fenty. He said that they won't know the full numbers of dead until later on today. So far, seven confirmed, two critically ill in hospital. The entertainer Ed McMahon has died at the age of 86. Now, a partner at the New York Times is calling him America's top second banana. And he's known, of course, for his role as Johnny Carson's affable sidekick on The Tonight Show. And that's a look at the news for now. John.
Thank you, Femi. Pop voice of Rihanna continues on despite the headlines regarding her assault by Chris Brown, who pled guilty yesterday to assault charges and was sentenced. Continuing our discussion with Elizabeth Mendez-Barry, freelance journalist here in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious.com. Listen to these two quotes from Oprah Winfrey, who I'm sure that you witnessed give some advice to Rihanna as the whole assault scandal was reaching its peak. Listen to this one first.
If you go back with a man who hits you, it is because you don't think you're worthy of being with a man who won't. That's why you do it.
Arguably one of the biggest celebrities in the world, giving some advice to one of the lesser celebrities, but still a huge celebrity. And here she continues.
Love doesn't hurt. I say they've been saying this to women
That's
for years.
Right.
Love doesn't yes. hurt. And if a man hits you once, yes. he will hit you again.
That's right.
Now, LaToya Peterson, here's a celebrity advising another celebrity. And, of course, the audience goes wild there on the Oprah show. Did that contribute, in your view, looking back now, to a serious debate on teen violence and the lessons that people need to take from this incident?
Unfortunately, not really. Oprah's comments were definitely common sense and definitely helpful. But as we've seen in these kind of relationships, it's not common sense that's winning out when you choose to go back to an abuser or when you're trying to make a decision or having issues with that. One of the things that I noticed in conversation, particularly in the blogosphere, and that's, you know, the primary place where I work, is that the tones of the conversation never really got discussed. So there were some definite themes that were emerging around the Chris Brown, Rihanna case. And those differed by racial lines, those differed by class lines, those differed by what people were expecting.
But what was the racial issue? What was the racial issue? I'm interested.
Okay, so the racial issue with Chris Brown and Rihanna, it was very interesting to watch the discussion and debate happen because on mainstream blogs like TMZ and Perez Hilton, they had already come to their conclusion. He is trash. It's done. Rihanna can't go back to him. She comes back to him. She's an idiot. There was a very marked shift in most of the mainstream blogs to completely and unequivocally support Rihanna. Whereas in the black gossip blogosphere, I'm saying black gossip specifically, so places like Bossip and a blog called Nicole Bitchy and things like that, there was a lot more of a division between people who felt like we should automatically support Rihanna because she was the victim and she was the person who was being unfortunately persecuted, and people going, wait a minute, this doesn't sound right. We need to start supporting Chris Brown. We don't know what happened, so we don't know what we should do. And as a result of those conversations, we started seeing another interesting pattern emerge where people started going, well, you know, Rihanna isn't really black. She's Caribbean. And so there was a distancing even from that within the black community where she's been generally accepted as a black artist. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, when this happens, it's, well, she's not really black. She's Caribbean. And you know how those women are.
Now,
so there became some intra-racial tensions along with the racial tensions and discussion.
That is really fascinating. I'm not trying to interrupt, but we got, you know, I could talk about this all hour long. But I'm wondering, you know, someone might say, Elizabeth, that that's a sign of, okay, here's a robust debate on subjects that people wouldn't talk about otherwise. Or is it the case of people sort of finding their own sort of constituency, finding their own form of denial in this, avoiding the real issue?
I would say it's mostly the latter, unfortunately, because I think when that polarizing happens, like I mentioned before, it's Team Rihanna, it's Team Breezy, and ultimately there's no real conversation about what the issues, the fundamental issues are, and why we're so emotional about this, which I believe are that we don't really know how to figure out how to have healthy relationships at a young age. And the reason that we're so attached to this specific case is because it mirrors issues that a lot of young people are experiencing in their own relationships.
Does celebrity culture, LaToya, support this kind of thing, since they're happy to market to the people who are pro-Chris and the people who are pro-Rihanna and have a magazine for both and a blog for both and maybe a set of songs for both, and you make money every side?
Right. I mean, unfortunately, what happens, or what we were seeing when the case was at its peak and at the height of speculation, is that it was kind of drowning out the idea or the need for an actual conversation, because people had already come to their own conclusions. And one of the things that really disturbed me on my blog was that when we first started the open thread about it, when it first broke, I'm watching the way that the conversation's going. And there's people, you know, it's a standard conversation about domestic violence where there are some people who are instantly denying it. Oh, he couldn't have done that. He's such a nice boy. This wouldn't have happened. And then there's the people who shifted into blaming. Well, we know Rihanna probably did something. She must have, quote, provoked it, which is something that I don't believe you can do, but that's another story.
Well,
and one of the important things is that we have teenagers who read our site, and we have teenagers who are looking and listening to the tones of our conversations around this and using that to indicate what their personal relationships are going to be. And so that shifted how we covered it from then on out, knowing that there are people who are observing and who are trying to make up their minds about their relationships based on what they're listening to adults say.
So who has the most powerful voice at this point? We're under a minute here. Is it Chris Brown's next move to say something that would be important here, or Rihanna's next move to say something important here? Elizabeth and then LaToya, you can take us out.
I think we all want Rihanna to be a heroine, and I think everybody wants her to come forward and have this transformative moment, which is exactly what Oprah would love on her show.
Right.
I think that the reality is that chances are she's going to need to do some healing before she can even get close to that. I wish that she would turn around and start looking at the hundreds of young women in this country who are actually in dating abusive relationships.
LaToya, you got the last word. 20 seconds.
Definitely. I feel like, though it's important to think about what celebrities' impact is, the people who will have the greatest impact on this are parents and people who work with youth, because you can really use this to start the conversation.
LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious.com, and Elizabeth Mendez Barry, freelance journalist. Thanks to both of you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now, they both belong to the ages.
Who do we have tomorrow?
I don't know.
Well,
I'm not going to be here. I don't know.
Are you putting me on?
No, I'm off. I'm going to be out of town tomorrow, so.
What do you mean you're going to be out of town?
I'm going to be.
Tomorrow's Friday.
I know that, but I can take a day off once in a while. You certainly invented it.
Early this morning, television legend Ed McMahon passed away. You may know him, of course, as the king of sidekicks from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson there on one of the shows before they left. They parted company as Tonight Show host and co-host back in the early 90s. Joining us is Bill Carter, media correspondent for The New York Times. Bill, thanks for joining us. We certainly lost a giant this morning, wouldn't you say?
I'd say so. I mean, you know, I guess he's the definition of whatever that thing is that's called a sidekick.
Exactly. It's something invented by television, but also invented by the persona of Ed McMahon. He began as a bingo caller in Maine. They first worked together on a daytime game show called Who Do You Trust? Their chemistry was truly amazing to behold.
Well, you know, it was because McMahon actually could be funny, as you could hear in that clip. He was pretty good at sort of puncturing Johnny in a way that wouldn't annoy Johnny, but he had good timing. You know, a straight man is very important in a comedy routine, very important. And McMahon was, in essence, Johnny's straight man.
And that timing was, you know, certainly what both of them were good at. But Ed McMahon also had a life outside of The Tonight Show that extended into other shows and other sort of personas. And I would have to say that just looking over the details this morning, his last years were certainly not happy ones for Ed McMahon. Describe that trajectory from The Tonight Show to his death this morning.
Well, you know, McMahon always was a really ambitious guy. Even when he was on The Tonight Show, he had all kinds of other businesses going all the time. You know, investment businesses, real estate, all this kind of thing. Johnny used to sort of make fun of him for it. So when he stopped being on The Tonight Show, he just pursued all these other avenues, including being host of Star Search and, you know, TV bloopers, and showed up all kinds of commercials. You know, obviously the giveaway commercial he was always on. But, you know, that piled up money for him, and it was rather shocking to find out that, you know, in the last 2 years, you know, they were foreclosing on his mortgage, and he was having all these financial difficulties. And his only comment about it was, you know, you can spend as much money as you make, and he must have spent a ton of money. I mean, he was divorced twice, and I guess that was very expensive for him, but he still, you know, he had income coming in. Even he was on a Super Bowl ad this year.
Wow.
So he was continually making money. That was for selling your goals, whatever goals
right.
you have. I mean, Ed would do almost, remember, he was also a guy who actually did commercials on The Tonight Show. Interestingly, an idea that's coming back, allegedly, when Jay Leno moves to primetime.
And, you know, before we go, Bill, you know, the fact that he was the host of Star Search in the American Idol era, it's really kind of ironic. I mean, what must have McMahon thought of that?
Interesting to think that, because you remember when Idol hit, they tried to bring Star Search back on CBS.
Right.
It was the sort of the precursor of that kind of show that he, you know, kind of was the front man for. And it was considered sort of a cheesy show in its time, not American, you know, this phenomenon that took over America. I'm sure he found that sort of ironic and probably disappointing because he couldn't have cashed in on that.
Well, Bill Carter, New York Times media correspondent, remembering Ed McMahon.
I hope that they remember that I had a very good military career. They asked me what I wanted on my tombstone, and I said I didn't want a tombstone, but if I had one, I'd want he was a good broadcaster and a great Marine.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm John Hockenberry. Is there a heaven for dead computers? Decidedly not. Find out why when we get done with headlines from Femi. Okay, you got one more chance now, Femi. Okay.
Good morning. This is going to be the slick, the wonderful, the gorgeous, the delicious, the femalicious newscast. Good morning, everybody. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The White House now calls Iran's election protests, I'm going to quote here, the beginnings of change, end of quote. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says that demonstrators are succeeding in calling attention to what's happening in Iran, but the president is not going to get involved with internal affairs in Iran.
We're not going to get involved in endorsing or not endorsing specific actions inside of Iran. This is for Iranians to debate their next leadership. I think the president wants to ensure that he doesn't become a political football that the regime uses against anybody that seeks justice in Iran.
President Obama will talk more on Iran in a couple of hours in a press conference. Iran's top election authority now says it will not allow a new vote. The Guardian cancels new message today, refuses to annul the controversial result. This comes even as the council admits to election irregularities in many areas. Russia is now backing the official Iranian government result. It calls election results an internal matter. And finally,
goodbye, old friend.
That's TV legend Ed McMahon. He is dead at 86. He was best known as the loyal, laughing sidekick to Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. And he died earlier on this morning in Los Angeles. As a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning, was that not slick?
Thank you, Femi. We'll keep you around for a while.
All right. Thanks,
John. Thank
you
so much. All right. So you ever wonder what happens to your computer when you send it to a recycling center? 80% of electronic waste from the United States gets shipped abroad to places in Africa and China. That's according to one recycling advocacy group. And the place where computers go when they die is nothing like heaven. It's more like hell. And in a digital dumping ground documentary on the Frontline World tonight from producer Peter Klein, you're going to see exactly what that hell is all about. Peter Klein is a former 60 Minutes producer, currently a producer for Frontline World, journalism professor at the University of British Columbia. He's here in the studio. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, this is a classic investigative story. Trace, you know, follow the waste in this particular case. People have found sort of the trail of toxic waste decades earlier, and the problem with disposing of all kinds of waste in the industrialized world, in the third world. E-waste is a special case. Explain what the challenges are.
Well, one of the challenges is that, like industrialized waste, there are a number of toxins within e-waste. There's lead, cadmium, all sorts of. When it's disposed of improperly, and particularly in Ghana, for instance, you know, it's just dumped in these open areas, and kids go through it and burn it to get the copper and get a couple pennies, but in the process, expose themselves to all sorts of toxins from the smoke. But there's a secondary part, which is that, you know, there's your data's on there.
Well, let's hold up on the data for a second, because that's a bit of a surprise.
Right.
That was the real shocker to me. But the environmental issue is really sort of focused in this selection from your Frontline World documentary, Digital Dumping Ground. First of all, let's listen to this and then explain what's going on here.
What is happening there is rather apocalyptic.
Behind these chimneys are the burn stations, all retrofitted. I smell the solder here. Let's get out.
One of the most disturbing things Puckett shows us is taking place behind closed doors. Women literally cooking circuit boards to salvage the computer chips, which have trace amounts of gold. They're slowly poisoning themselves with lead fumes.
Now, you're getting a tour from environmentalist Jim Puckett, who talks about what's exactly happening when we say our computers are being recycled. It must have been pretty shocking to see these women in the midst of this smoke.
It was a pretty surreal experience. I mean, what we did is we went to three different countries, but this clip you just heard was in China. I took my graduate students with me. So we were going through this town called Guiyu, which has gotten some press in the past. I mean, there's just nothing but lines and lines and lines of electronic waste everywhere. But what few people have actually seen, because usually people go in sort of, with all guns blaring and they get in trouble. We tried to go in very low key and sort of just quietly walked around and slipped into these little storefronts. And they look like innocent little storefronts with chimneys. But in fact, inside there are these women sitting in front of little coal-fired ovens cooking, literally cooking circuit boards. You know, they sort of this sensitive-looking green and metal plastic things. They just stick it on top of an oven, and it just melts away the lead. In the process, they're freebasing lead.
Now, what is the money trail here? I mean, who pays to, first of all, get rid of the stuff, then who pays to mine the toxins, and then who actually ends up paying the workers?
Well, we try to, there's a lot of levels. One thing we try to do is follow it on the China side, on the Hong Kong side. So we got these advertisements, which openly solicit, this is illegal, by the way, but openly solicit, you know, send us your e-waste from the West to China and we'll take care of it. So I said, okay, well, let's go talk to this guy. Nobody would talk to us on camera. So I wore a hidden camera and went to speak with one of these guys in Hong Kong. And he was incredibly honest. I mean, he was very well-educated. He'd spent a lot of time actually in Canada. And he's like, Adam Smith knows what he's talking about. You know, let the market demand what it demands. And, we can do it really cheaply. And we're a developing country. And, yeah, so there'll be some environmental problems, but we'll make money. So what there's a huge industry that's blown up because they're able to spend very, very little on the labor and reclaim the precious metals.
And no worker regulations, no environmental or union regulations to protect the workers.
Exactly. And on the US side, it's just a lot cheaper, and not just cheaper, it's lucrative. If you go and donate your computer or recycle your computer, they have to actually spend money to go recycle it domestically, or they can sell it to one of these guys abroad for a couple pennies a pound.
And, of course, aside from the environmental issue, there's the question of all that data. And here, while it's not a toxic issue, it certainly was a surprise. Listen to this and then tell me what's going on here.
How much if I wanted to get one of those?
350.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
My students take the hard drives to Regent University in the Ghanaian capital and ask computer scientist Enoch Kwesi Messiah to help us read them.
Will we be able to see the information on the drive?
Yes.
From just hooking all that up?
Yes, sir.
Just as simple as that?
Yes, simple as that.
So you sent your students to Ghana on a data trail.
Right.
And what did they find?
Well, Ghana is an interesting country because it's listed as one of the top 10 sources of cybercrime by the FBI. And we know that the Nigerian syndicates are involved there with their sort of scams. You know, you get those emails all the time. So we thought, well, here are our old computers with our data are sitting in dumps. Is there a potential threat there? And what that woman you just heard, Krisha Collier, one of my students, went and bought a bunch of these drives and took it to this guy and said, oh, what's on here? And what was on there was, you know, pictures of little kids, bathing, the kind of pictures.
Wedding pictures, wedding regular pictures, but also the identities, passwords.
Credit card numbers. But then, you know, one of the big shockers was among the seven drives we bought, one of them happened to be from a major military contractor in Washington.
You're kidding.
Yeah. I mean, it was from Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman's drive was sitting in a dump in Ghana, and we recovered just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of documents that related to $500 million, $200 million government contracts with the Defense Intelligence Agency, with NASA, with TSA, with the Transportation Security Administration, how to go about hiring air marshals, how to go about hiring airport screeners. So it was pretty serious stuff.
Just sitting in a dump.
Just waiting there.
Now, aren't companies that you give your computer to obligated to destroy the data or to say that they've somehow, formatted these hard drives and that the data is gone?
They are. Unfortunately, there's not... there's virtually no regulation. A big government accountability office study last year found they actually did their own sort of sting domestically and found that a number of these places, reputable places, which said that they were going to take care of electronic waste safely and soundly, ended up shipping it abroad because it's an easy trail.
If you recycle your computer and your identity is stolen and you can trace it to a piece of hardware that you gave to a recycler, is there any recourse that you have? Is there any liability on their part?
Well, there are laws.
There
are laws in the United States.
Nice.
The FACT Act, which actually requires that all personal data be removed from computers, but they're largely unenforceable.
Nice. Check your local listings tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on PBS. The story on Frontline World, the world's digital dumping ground. My guest, Frontline World producer Peter Klein, thanks so much for being with us. We're also talking about Iran all day, and we want to hear what's striking you most about the coverage. Come up with your own headline for today's news. Karen Trott wrote us an email with her headline, "What's being left out of the conversation? Any mention of our own 2000 election debacle? Why have we avoided comparisons?" Actually, we made one on this show right this morning. Tell us your headline at our website, thetakeaway.org. Maybe your headline is, where are the nukes in Iran? What about freedom for the Iranian people? Here's your takeaway.
Those under the age of 40 who are there in spirit and see themselves as brothers and sisters of those who are on the streets have viewed the American response as dead on. And I think Obama has towed a dead on but delicate stance of standing up for free speech and freedom of assembly, but not injecting the United States into domestic politics in Iran.
That's Amir Farouki's headline. He's an attorney in Atlanta, one of the Iranian-American community here in the United States. And here's your takeaway.
There are various ways you can do that. It could be, hi-oh. Or it could be, hello, you let it trail off to zero.
Thanks for that. Ed McMahon, dead at age 86. Rest in peace, Ed McMahon. I'm John Hockenberry with no sidekick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Hi-yo!
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.